Good morning. Hope you can hear me well. My name is Geir Ola Dirkelbotten. I teach a course in reverse engineering and malware analysis, and your teacher Lasse has asked me to come here today and give an introduction to malware analysis. I'll do my best. This is based on two of the lectures that I do for the students in my own class. We're going to cover. Let me get the feedback off here. There you go. I'm going to do my best to go through static analysis, where we look at malware without running it, and then we're going to have some simple or basic dynamic analysis where we try to run it and see what's going on. First, just want to show you some names on the screen here now. These are the top threats. The way the EU CERT sees it as of September 2016. And if you notice, then the banking Trojans and is high up there on fifth. Ransomware is also up there. But the three top ones, Turla, Sophocy, and Kichang, are all in the category APT, Advanced Persistent Threat. Professional organizations with lots of time and resources. Just wanted to mention it so you have a somewhat motivation for why we're doing this. And I don't know if you, at what level you will do malware analysis, or if you will at all. But if we look at the number two there, Sophocy, again, according to the EU CERT, then this group has many names. Fancy Bear, APT28, Pawnstorm, Sednit, SAR Team. This has been attributed back to Russia. What happens here is that when they start seeing campaigns, they look for similarities, and then they group them and see this campaign looks like this campaign. Let's call it a name, and they give that group a name, let's say APT28. And then as the investigation goes on, more and more indicators might tie the analysis to a certain group or even country. And campaigns that are associated with Sophocy has been listed at the bottom of the slides, and you probably will recognize the U.S. Democratic Party, been a lot in the news, and also the World Anti-Doping Agency, and since there's a German in the classroom here, the German CDU party is also, and the German Bundestag has also been attacked by Sophocy. And the reason I'm saying this is not that we're going to go after one or two groups here today, but this kind of information is how is what must be behind claims like USA saying that Russia is behind the attack. You cannot make a claim like that without having lots of information to back this up. And the topic of today, malware analysis, is key to providing the information on what's going on, grouping the attacks, and attributing them to certain groups, similarities or fingerprints in the code that eventually lets you, with a certain probability, of course, tie it to people, organizations, or even countries. So that was just a short motivation and introduction. Let's see. Close that and go over to first topic of today. And for when I teach this in the IMT 4116 reverse engineering and malware analysis, my students have this book at hand. It's called Practical Malware Analysis: Hands-on Guide to Dissecting Malicious Software by Michael Sikorsky and Andrew Hunig. It looks like this. If you want to pursue malware analysis, this is really the book to start with. wherever I go and talk to people doing malware analysis and ask them, how should I start? They very often point to this book. My presentations are based on chapter 1 and 3 in this book. So since my students have to buy it, some of the slides might refer to things that you don't have available. So I'm sorry for that. But again, if you really want to work with this, then I would highly recommend to buy the book. That book also have labs associated with it. You can download the malware from the internet, and there it works on XP, so that's a little challenging, but for the most part the labs are excellent also if you want to dig in deeper. So I'll go through the theory of chapter 1 and basic static techniques, and then I'll go through the theory of chapter 3, which is basic dynamic techniques, and then I think I have time towards the end to do a demonstration of some of the tools and on one particular malware. So that's the plan. So, basic static techniques. This is usually step number one. What you try to do is analyze the code, find a structure to determine what it's doing. When we're talking about static techniques, the malware is not running, and that's important. And to do static analysis, you can use antivirus tools, hash, but what really gives a lot of information is also strings, functions, and headers of the malware. Just to mention that in the beginning too, this there's, of course, malware for lots of different platforms. Both the book that I'm using and the course that I'm teaching focuses on Windows platform and executables on the Windows operating system. So the reason behind that is that that's where we find the most of the malware. You will find tons of malware for Linux and other Android and other operating systems, but we had to make a choice. We can't cover everything in one course. Antivirus scanning, use the first step, relies on file signatures, or could rely on heuristics like behavior and pattern matching analysis. So I'm sure you probably know it's not perfect. As the malware can easily change the signature, and this is an arms race going on, new detection signatures, malware writers change their malware and go undetected, and then we need new signatures and so forth. And also the different antivirus programs use different signatures and heuristics, so it would be, if you can, running multiple antivirus programs will give you better coverage. And virus total that you find online might be a good indication of that. They have about 50, if you upload a piece of code to them, they have about 50 different virus solutions that they run the code against, and then they show you some static information, but also they show you, in this case, difficult to read, I think it said 49 out of 57 hits, so in this case, the malware that was uploaded, brbbot.exe, most virus companies detected. I'm going to keep repeating that throughout this today. Be aware when you use online tools, attackers will, at least serious ones, will monitor the online tools. So if you're the first one to upload a new code to VirusTotal, you can be sure that you also let the malware writer know that, hey, somebody's onto us and found our code. And sometimes you might not want to do that. Hash is also used as a fingerprint for malware. So this can uniquely identify at least one particular instance of the malware. Using MD5 or SHA-1, And there are some tools listed there, MD5 Deep, WinMD5 for Windows, and MD5 for Linux, that will provide this. Here's an example of the WinMD5, where you, let's see if we can get the mouse over here, you drop or refer to the malware in this window here. You get the MD5 checksum down here, and if you comfortable with it and think that's okay, you can verify this with online services by using this verify button. So what can we use it for? Of course, label the malicious file, say, hey, this is what I've seen. You can share it with others to let them give them a heads up, or you can search online and see did somebody already analyze this. Then there's something we call fuzzy hashing. With the cryptographic or traditional hash, you can, of course, identify identical files. But if you change just one bit in your file, then you have a new hash, and it's worthless. So the benefit of this, of course, is if you get a match, then you're certain that you have the same file. But it also, this is one of the reasons why there are so many samples out there, because the malware writers change a little bit, and you have to publish a new hash. So with the fuzzy hashing, you do piecewise hashing instead, and then you're able to identify not identical files, but similar files. And that could be of great benefit if you're looking for just different versions of the same malware. Of course, that also comes with less certainty that you have a hit. That's the trade-off you have. Tools to do this, SSDeep. By the way, if anyone online wants to, I have opened Collaborate under the your course. So if you want to log on there and ask me questions, I'll try to pay attention to that as well. I have a list of all these tools that I'm mentioning today. I have a list and a brief description of them, and I'll see if I can post that on your under the course on Blackboard if you're interested. Okay, strings are important, at least as a first glance. So, sequence of characters, you use it to print messages, connect the URLs, copy files, and they're great about giving hints on the functionality of the code. They can really tell a lot. Tools to use, strings or programmed part of the Windows system internals, or so many programs that will give you, I'll show you later, that can give you information about the strings. Good to know, you have to know that there are different types or standards. So the ASCII characters, 1 byte, also named called ANSI. Unicode, 2 bytes, or often referred to as white characters in Microsoft. They both end with the null terminator, as this bad example shows. So ASCII, just 42, 41, 44, and then it ends. But with the Unicode, you have the double zero in between, so you use 2 bytes. This has implications if the program uses Unicode and you're looking for ASCII, or the other way around, this might be not give you the best result. So the strings program that can show you this, and other program, they ignore the context and formatting when they search. So they might identify a lot of things as strings, which are really not strings. And if you look at the example here, just that those bytes there will be interpreted as VP3. Probably nothing to do with strings. So that should be ignored. So these sequences could be memory addresses, CPU instructions, and other things, but these programs are not smart enough, so they will make mistakes. So you have to filter out the invalid strings, and many times it's obvious, other times it's not. The example here, the top ones, VP3, VW3, and so forth, can usually be ignored. Then you have one, number four there, that really looks like an IP address. That could be worth looking into. Sometimes it's that easy to get information out. Then you have number one and two are Windows functions, or one DLL and one function. One and two are functions, and number three is the Windows DLL, dynamic link library. We'll talk more about that in a little bit. And also number five is interesting, and sometimes even the malware needs to communicate either with the infected computer or with the back to the malware writer. And in this case, it looks like an error message indicating that something to do with mail. Okay, so maybe this program sends some kind of mail somewhere, maybe to that IP address there if we're lucky. So studying this can give you hints, and hints are always important. We have, of course, in order to avoid this, I'm going to cover packed and obfuscated malware, because the malware writers, they don't want to make it this easy for us. So they want to hide the code and the execution. And packing has been around for a long time. Started off with being used to compress files when disk space or was a problem. The thing to remember here is that the packed executable must be unpacked in memory to be run. That's something that we can exploit when we analyze. But bear in mind that if you run across packed malware, then static analysis really has limits, because you, as we'll see in this one, what this figure shows is that you have the original executable here, where you start executing the code from here. Then you pack this. And in this executable, you have strings and all the information visible for static analysis. But when you pack it in here, you need a small portion in the beginning, a wrapper program that tells the computer, how do I unpack this so I get back to the original executable? And when you do static analysis without unpacking, all you see is what the wrapper program uses. So that's normally doesn't give you much information. For those that like to purchase the book, there's a reference to chapter 18, whole chapter on just packers and unpackers. UPX is one type, very common, but that's also easy to unpack. If you're lucky and the malware uses that, then the analysis is quite straightforward. But there are numerous others, more complex is listed there. There also, you can customize your own, and then there's usually no built-in unpacking, and it might be difficult to unpack as well. Another term that you need to know about working with malware is this term, indicator or compromise. So that's any indicator that we find that tells us that we might be dealing with malicious code. And in this case, a legitimate program that has not been packed has many strings, and obfuscated packet has few strings. So few strings could be an indicator of compromise. But beware, because there could be several other reasons why You find few strings. Maybe the legitimate program was packed for some reason. So you need to do more investigation. If you see if you see the strings, we'll come back to these are functions, load library and get proc address and few strings, then that's often obfuscated code that loads additional functionality. Excuse me. You can also use entropy as an indication whether it's packed or not. If it's packed, then it will have a higher entropy, so a more uniform distribution than if it's not packed. There are also tools to detect packers. PEID is one such tool that it identifies UPX. If you open the executable in this program, if it recognizes the packing method, it will write it on here. And then you go online and you see if there is unpacking procedure out there. And if it is, then you're lucky. If it's not, then not so lucky. Then it's more difficult. So unpacking, like I said, go online. UPX has one. But you the automatic unpacking, even though you find a code, might not always work because it's only a little change they can do and customize this, and then it will fail. But there is a powerful method that I will not cover today, but you can bear it in mind if you need to. Also covered in the book if you want to learn more. Like I said a couple of slides ago, the malware, of course, needs to unpack itself in order to work. And you can exploit that with tools. You can set breakpoints in the code so you can stop the execution right when it's unpacked and right before it starts executing. And if you dump the memory then you should have a fair chance of getting a copy of the unpacked malware. And then just a warning. Some of the tools that I'm listing in that are properly to use, like PEID, will execute the malware without warning. Bear that in mind. Some tools are discontinued and have also unknown origin, like the PID 0.92 is vulnerable to buffer overflow. So the question here is, could these tools be malicious themselves? And the answer is yes. And I asked this question to somebody in this community, and there are two things you can do. First of all, you can use tools that are best practice in the community, and that's the list I can provide you with. And then it's the bottom one is really important. Always use a safe environment, and at least the way we do it, that means a virtual machine like VMware or similar. So you can reset the system if something goes wrong. And be careful about whether you're connected to the internet or not, preferably not when you execute malware. So that's just a couple of things to watch out for. Since we're focusing on the Windows operating system and the executables there, we need to talk about portable executable file format, or the PE format, used in Windows 32 and 64-bit operating system. Since I haven't taught this class, I'm going to ask you in class here, have you covered this before? Are you familiar with the PE structure? Have you, Lasse, been through that?
No, not really.
No, not really? Okay. It is a data structure, and it contains the information necessary for the operating system to load the executable. Because when you execute the code, there's an OS loader that takes this code and sort of unwraps it, and it loads it into memory and finds all the components it needs. And all this is stored, or the information needed to do this is stored in the PE header. And if you study that information, that could be of great value. It could tell you what type of application it is, library functions, space requirements, etc. So we're going to look a little bit on it. Some types of PE files, EXE, DLL, system files, OCX, ActiveX control, CPL, and screensavers are examples of PE files. Mostly we're going to stick with, or at least in my course, we usually look at EXE or DLLs, dynamic link libraries. This is just a teaser. Not expecting you to read that at all, but this is, if you go to openrce.org, this is a very good overview of the PE structure. And this structure is lots of great information for the malware analysts, but it's also a source of exploitation for the malware writers, because they, when they know that executables have this structure, they can also exploit how this works to hide code that can be difficult to find. And of course, there are tools for examining the PE files as well. A number of them here: PE View, CFF Explorer, PE Bear, PE Browser, Professional, PE Explorer, and more. And they basically read the header and display it in a way like this. So image DOS header, MS stub program, NT header, and so forth. And we'll have a quick look at some of them. So the image DOS header, or the MS-DOS and the MS-DOS stub program, that's, if you go back here, that's the first beginning here. That's historical and usually little or no interest. There are some bytes in there that gives away that this is actually a Windows executable. Then you come to the image NT headers. There's a signature that is always the same, but there's a time stamp in there, and that is the compilation time, or at least it's supposed to be. So if they don't tamper with it, then the timestamp when there was compiled can be useful to see if you have an old or new version of the code. But like much else, it can be faked or fixed. And if you're, let's see, they use the Delphi programs, they always set this to June 19th, 1992. So that doesn't give any other information that Delphi was involved. The optional header can have some useful information. One example is to say if this is a console or a GUI program. It also contains the PE header also contains information about sections where you find really important things. In the dot text, you find the executable code, so that's the actual CPU instructions that the computer will execute. Then you have import and export information, so that's the libraries that, or functions from other programs that this code might want to use or export and provide to other programs. Global data, and then resources like strings, icons, images, and menus are found. So these are the most typical sections to find, but down here there are some other listed. And if you see anything else than this, then at least it's worth looking into why it is like that. So the image section header in the PE file, there's a description of each of the different sections. And one thing we can use this for is to look at the size and compare the virtual size and the raw data size, and this can tell us if if there's anything suspicious going on. So if you see this one, the virtual and the raw data size is about the same, and that's from program from the book they call Potential Keylogger. And then if you see here, there's a Potential Pact program, and you see the virtual size is much larger than the size of the raw data. So that's suspicious. And also you see it down here. There's a different view for the PACT programs. Also virtual size and raw data size are different. There's a large difference that indicates a PACT or obfuscated program. Tools, resource hacker. Can show strings, icons, menus from the resource section of the pheather. Like I said, mapper writers also really know this PE information, and they often embed programs in this section where they shouldn't be. And this tool, Resource Hacker, lets you extract malware from those regions. So a little summary of the what the PE header can give you. Imports and exports, coming a little bit to that in the next couple of slides. But imports, the functions that you want to use. Exports, the function you want to provide to others. Time, date stamp, the sections, maybe subsystems and resources. Are useful information found there. All right, we have usually take a break at 9, isn't that so?
Oh, yes.
Yep, then we'll carry on a little bit more. Linked libraries and functions. When you program, then you don't have to program everything yourself. Some people have implemented functions before that you just reuse, and that makes a lot of sense. And Windows provide a lot of functions that you don't have to program yourselves. But these functions must be imported into the code. And that is what is called imports. So functions used by the program that are stored in a different program and used for then many programs. And then it's different ways of linking to these libraries. So how do you get to use the code? And we're going to look at static, runtime, and dynamic linking because it affects how much information we can get out of the code. Because really, if you can see what functions the code needs, it really tells a lot about what it's doing. So static linking, that's when you copy everything that others have written before into your program and just have it there. Copy in everything you need. Of course, your executable will grow in size, and it's difficult to see what did you write and what did others write. And if you do this, there is no indication in the PE header because the PE header does not know what you made and what others made. This is probably the least commonly used method. Unix and Linux programs use it, but that's not the focus there. Then you have runtime linking. That's when you connect or link with a library only when you need it. So you execute the code, and when you come down to the function or you need, then you provide a link. This is commonly used in malware, and especially packed and obfuscated malware, and written unpopular in friendly programs. This is one of those things, at least, that is dominated by the malware writers. And if you see the function calls get proc address and load library, that is to get the address for a certain function that you need and load it into your program. So these two will help you find and include libraries on the fly. So if this is used, runtime linking, then I expect to see these two function calls, and often in packed malware, these are the only functions or one of the few that are provided before you unpack the code. The consequences for you or for us is that the static analysis that we're covering in this lecture cannot provide much information because it's hidden. You don't know what functions are used until you run the program. And remember, static analysis is about not running the program. Last one, dynamic linking. That's when you double-click on a program and execute it, that's when the OS loader search up and include all the libraries that you have told the program that you need. And that is by the most common method. And in this case, the PE header will store the information about all the libraries that you need and all the functions you need, or at least all the libraries and the functions that you have told the program that you need. When you execute it, you might not actually use all of them. And it's a fine difference there, because if you see that the program loads a certain library and a function, that doesn't necessarily mean it uses it. So, said it a couple of times now, libraries and functions, important for guessing what the program does. So if you see the URL download to file function, then it's certainly an okay guess to say this might be a piece of code that connects to the internet and downloads files. And that's nice to know when you study malware. So information about the specific functions can be found in the PE header if they use the right method. If you want to find out about the function, the libraries and functions that Windows provide, there's a page that I highly recommend that you make yourself familiar with. It's the Microsoft Developer Network MSDN library. And this is some, I don't know any malware analyst that know that by heart. You need to go in there frequently. And you come across a function, what is this doing? Go to that page, look it up. Highly recommended. In the Appendix A, and this is for those of you that choose to buy the book again, there is a list of commonly used functions by malware. And this can also be found in the MSDN. Exploring libraries and functions. The book, uses a tool called Dependency Walker. But you can also, IDA Pro is the de facto standard in disassembler used for malware analysis, and I'll show it to you briefly later if you haven't seen it. So these are two methods of finding out which libraries and functions were imported. The import can be done by name, so you can use the, like I showed here, if you see the URL download to file, that's sort of obvious what it does. But there's also a different way of doing it by ordinal, and then you just have to look up and see what name is this linked to. So just a quick view. I hope this is readable. If not, I'm going to provide the slides afterwards, so you get to study it. But just a big overview here. Up here is the executable. So if you see here, number one, this is the executable you ask Dependency Walker to analyze. Then it lists here what DLLs, or what libraries is it asking for? Is it importing? In this case, it's kernel 32 and VS232. And if you highlight one of them, you will get the, in this window, you will get the functions of that library that this program asks for. And now we're being too quiet in the classroom, so the light goes off. They might leave it off. So, so this top one here, number three, that's the functions that the program actually asks for. The bottom one, number four, that's all the functions that that library provides. And then there's five and six, some additional information that is usually not that that relevant. A list, I also provided a list of common DLLs. Kernel 32, very common. Core functionality, access and manipulation of memory files and hardware, so you will almost always see this. ADV API 32, access to advanced core Windows components, service manager and registry. I'll come back to that, but I'll mention it now. If you want to create persistence, so if you want the malware to stay on your computer after reboot, you need one way of doing that is to change the register for what programs are started at startup. And you can do that with functions in this library. User 32, user interface components, buttons, scroll bars, so forth, user actions. I hate it, this mouse disappears from your screen too fast. GDI 32, displaying and manipulating graphics. NTDLL, this is an interesting one because it's it gives you interface to the Windows kernel, so low-level functions. And normal executable shouldn't have this or need it, because if it's needed, it's loaded by this, kernel 32. So if you see this being used, you might suspect or at least look for functionalities that it's trying to hide. So it's worth, if you see this, then dig deeper. Then you have three libraries at the bottom there, WSOC 32 and VS2 32 and WinENet. That's networking. The two first ones provide basic network-related tasks, and the bottom one, higher-level FTP, HTTP, NTP, so forth. So if you see this, then suspect malware that connects to the internet, and if you see WinINet, then suspect higher-level internet protocols. Let me see. I think that's a good. We'll. I have a few more slides on this, but I think we'll take a break. Not wear you out. We'll be back for those online 9:15. Okay. Welcome back. Let's continue. So we just looked at common DLLs, which are Windows libraries that the code might ask for, and it can give away lots of information about what the code is trying to do. When we come to functions included in these libraries, you need to be aware of some naming conventions. So here's an example for the create window, which is the original function. If you see ex as a suffix, that just indicates that it had a major update. And sometimes you see it's a second ex, so that's just a second major update on the function. And a different naming convention is the create directory. It's the will be the name that Microsoft used in their documentation. But you can specify whether it accepts ASCII or the wide character string with an A or a W. So if you come across this, then you at least know what it's about. I refer to Appendix A in the book. Here are some examples of functions that can tell you a lot about what the code is doing. Let's see if I can find the mouse again. There you go. So, create file. If you look up on the web page, you'll see that create file, obviously you can create new files. But you can also open an existing file. So just that you see create file doesn't mean that there's something new. It could just mean that they're reading an existing file. Create mutex. Mutex is something that the OS is using to make sure there's only one single instance running. Malware uses this to make sure that the computer is not affected by this sample before. So we'll create a mutex, check if that exists, and if it does, then hey, I've been here before. The great thing then is that these mutexes for malware purposes are often hard-coded, so it's one word that is the same for all infections, and it's a great source for signatures. Create process, launching a new process. Create remote thread, could be stealthy inject. Get adapter information. You can check out the network adapter information, and maybe you're looking for anti-virtual machine techniques. So some malware will try to find out, am I running in a virtual machine environment? And if they detect that, they might misbehave or do something else than they were intended. That is actually less of a problem now than before, because a few years back, then running in a virtual environment was synonym with being analyzed. But today, the virtual environment is used by corporations to more and more to provide services to their users. So malware writers, of course, want to exploit this and no longer stop functioning if they detect a virtual machine. Get key state. Maybe you have a keylogger. Internet open. Internet access. Internet write file. Writes data to open URL. So this might be exfiltration of information, or it can be used for that. Open process could be code inject. And reg open key might indicate that they're manipulating the registers and want to create persistence. Just bear in mind, as I said many times, these are indicators and not the truth, so you need to dig deeper in order to confirm this. We talked about imported functions, but there's also something called exported functions. And of course, in DLL, that's common, because the DLL is just a collection of functions where the whole purpose is to export it for you to use in other programs. But exported function is not common in regular executables, so EXEs. So if you find export functions, then it's often useful or at least worth looking into, hey, why is this happening? Just bear in mind, export functions can be named whatever you like. And of course, the sophisticated advanced malware writer exploit this to mislead you. If you're lucky, they use standard names and you get some information there. But so just bear in mind, names alone might be a limited use, but just the fact that they export something might be a clue. Tools to look here, again, Dependency Walker, IDA Pro, or any other program that will look at imports and exports. We're going to look at a couple of examples from the book. I'm not going to do this as a demo, but because I don't have those two exact malware samples there, but I'll go through it on slides just to show you what we can do. So one is a potential keylogger, and one is a packed program. So what's in the book is that when you study the imported DLLs and the functions found in this malware with the obvious name potential keylogger, you'll see that it will list many functions, so it's not packed, but there's only a few that are relevant. And to pick out the relevant ones, there's no way around it. That's experience and lookup in Appendix A or in MSDN, and do this over and over and over again. But this malware, or we don't know if it's malware yet, let's keep the suspense a little bit longer. This potential keylogger asks for kernel 32. Kernel 32, then we know, okay, it asks for this. That means it could possibly open and manipulate processes by using these functions. Open process, get current process, get process heap. It also has the ability to open and manipulate files by using functions like read file, create file, and write file. It can search through directories by find first file, find next file, and so forth. So these are by asking for kernel 32, this is what it can potentially do. Then it asked for user 32 DLL. And there we find GUI manipulation functions, register class, set windows, show window. So when the malware asks for this library, and if the PE header then also reveals that these are the functions that the program asks for in that library, well, it most likely have a GUI. And it might, but it may not be visible to the user. We don't know that, but that's an assumption. Then it asks for set window hook EX. I know you know that EX means a major update. That's an indicator of compromise for keylogger. It's commonly used to get keyboard inputs. It has legitimate uses, but if you see it and you're looking for malware, then you should the flag should go up and you should look into this more closely and confirm or reject your hypothesis. It also asks for register hotkey, and that is control shift P or something like that. And here's the book. It takes the bold assumption that says that, hey, this might be to harvest the collected data. When the malware has harvested enough data, you hit this key combination, and that's when you download it. Furthermore, it asks for GDI32. That's graphic related. That might confirm the GUI hypothesis. Shell32 DLL provides the opportunity to launch other programs, of course, both malicious and legitimate. And then it asks for the ADV API32, which I talked about earlier, that can manipulate the registers. And if it does, then you should look for strings that look like directories, and especially this one, software Microsoft Windows current version run, because that's the auto run at startup and commonly used for persistence. This library gives the code the ability to manipulate this and maybe create persistence. This particular potential keylogger.exe also have some exports, which is not common. low-level keyboard procedure and low-level mouse procedure. This is the same name as the Microsoft documentation. Remember, these could be changed to anything you want. And used with the set Windows hook, these might be used to send keyboard and or decide what would happen when the keyboard or the mouse is used. So keystroke, what do you want the program to do then? So based on this, remember this is an example, based on this, the book then forms a hypothesis and says that based on what we've seen in static analysis, this is likely a keylogger using set Windows hook to record keystrokes. It's likely they think it has a GUI display only to a specific user. They think it has a hotkey for the malicious user to then enter and see the GUI and retrieve the recorded keystrokes. And due to the persistence of the register, the ability to manipulate a register, they think that maybe this program loads at startup. So this was the hypothesis based on looking at static information in the program. And of course, I don't know if it looks simple or, but of course a book always picks good examples. But this is really what you need to try to do with static analysis. Get an overview, see what's suspicious, and form a light hypothesis, and then use other techniques to confirm or deny that hypothesis. So let's look at the PAC program. Well, when they do the same for that, they find no readable strings and only a short list of imports. And that's suspicious, because, or at least that tells us that this program is most likely PAC, because even a small program has more imports than this. So all it asks for is kernel 32 and a few functions, and the one function in user DLL, and this is a typical PAC program. And if you look here, I mentioned load library and get proc address, so this is what the program then uses to get more functions that you don't see right now. In this case, there's no hypothesis, it's just saying, hey, basic static analysis fails. We need something else, and what we need is dynamic analysis, and that is the next topic that I will cover. Quick summary. So basic static, simple first step, look at virus signatures, hashes, strings, import-export functions, get a first impression, and collect these indicators of compromise. That then help you decide where to start deeper analysis. Basic dynamic analysis is never going to give you the solution, but it's when you have either lots of malware to analyze or potential malware to analyze, or if you have a huge executable and you don't know where to start, basic analysis, static analysis can very often give you the can guide you to the point where it's smart to start first. So with that, we're going to go to basic dynamic. That means running the malware, and then we need a safe environment. Again, I don't know what we're not going to run any malware on your computer here today, but if you want to, if you're curious, I could provide what you need. I don't know if you have. Do you have a virtual machine in this class, or?
It's not on Windows.
Yeah. Okay. Then we'll talk to Lars and see what we do. It's if not, you have to take my class next time. Well, and then you get it. But running it, you need a safe environment to execute malware. Anything else is just crazy. Lab is not relevant for you. So any questions? Everything was crystal clear. So, okay. Then 2 minutes that we change the scenery here, and I'll start the next presentation. Okay. Chapter 3 in the book, Basic Dynamic Analysis. Warning, what I'm showing here, and this is most relevant if you choose to get the book and do the labs, it is live malware. And the one that I'm going to use as a demo is also live malware, and that means it's built for a certain purpose. And if you execute that on your computer, all sorts of things can happen. You don't want to do that. So be careful. Use a safe environment. The book also explains how to build this if you're interested. So basic dynamic analysis is all about let's run the malware and see what happens. If you hear the word behavioral analysis, that's pretty much the same. And we want to interact with the malware if we can. And the whole point here is to find more indicators of compromise, or to confirm and deny the suspicious or the hypothesis that our basic analysis gave. And why do we do that? Well, we saw that in the previous lecture. If, let's say, if it's obfuscated or packed, then the basic analysis might reach the dead end. We don't get any further. We might have tried all the analysis techniques that we have, static analysis techniques. Dynamic analysis is really efficient way to see what it does. So we monitor it as it runs, and then we do some examination afterwards. If the basic analysis told us this is the library that it asked for, these are the function it asks for, running the malware will show what it actually uses. Of course, there are limitations there too, because there might be triggers in the malware that we don't know about that prevents it from executing the correct way there and then. But that's a deeper topic. That's the second to the last limitation I mentioned there. It may not execute all paths as it's run. It might be command line malware. And there is a risk to the system. Even with the virtual machine and the safe environment, there is a risk that the malware is smart enough to escape our protective measures. So don't think that running malware is completely without risk. That's why I'm usually saying in the safe environment is one thing, but if you see, I have two computers up here. So I don't mix malware over on my everyday computer. I have a dedicated computer for this, and that's recommended if you have the opportunity. Okay, a couple of things. Sandboxes. This is the quick and dirty approach. Maybe you use sandboxes, but you run untrusted programs in a safe environment without fear of harming the real system. Usually fully automated. Good for the first tests. And but bear in mind that at least if you use online sandboxes, you have to be willing to submit your malware. There are several reasons why you may not want to. You may not want to reveal that your company has been targeted for public relations reasons or whatever. Or you don't want to alert the malware writers or the attacker that you're onto them. But if you're willing to submit the malware online, then there's a lot of okay tools. You could, of course, purchase this offline version, but then you need a lot of money. And this automated analysis, well, you'll get some more details like network activity, file activity, register activity, mutexes, like I mentioned. And you might get the virus total result. Some drawbacks, just go quickly through them. You don't have the command line inputs, may not record all events. Your environment might not provide the values that the malware is looking for. And the sandbox can't tell you what the objective is. It only that you need to find out yourself. And I added a disclaimer at the bottom there. I just included a sandbox for here to make this presentation more complete. The course that I'm teaching is not a sandbox course. And the book that I'm using is a few years old. So it might be that modern sandboxes are more sophisticated than what I just presented here, which is based on the book. But if you want to learn about sandboxes, then yeah. This is not the place. So, basic dynamic analysis, a procedure. How do we do this? We use a five-step procedure. Probably make up a procedure with more steps if you want to be more detailed. But it basically comes down to activate a set of monitoring tools. Then you run the malware. You terminate the malware, you pause the monitoring tools, and you examine logs. It's kind of obvious, if you ask me. But it's quite nice to, when a lot of things are happening, it's nice to have a good procedure. And I could have added two more and said it was a seven-step procedure because you always start and finish with a clean image in your virtual machine. We're going to go through each of these steps. Some of them will have more details than others. So step one, activate monitoring tools. And then the obvious question is, what do we monitor? And ideally, you want to look for absolutely everything. That would be nice, but not very practical. But at least local activities such as file systems, did it read? Tamper with, create some files, registry is nice to monitor, and also processes. And then, of course, network activity is the malware trying to communicate with the outside world. So either monitor metadata or packet the packet headers or even the whole payload. So how do we do this? Many ways, but what I'm going to show you is through these tools listed here. We need a task manager. Then we can either use Process Hacker or one that is called Process Explorer. We have tools to look at the processes being created and deleted and what's going on, process monitor, procmon, or CaptureBat. Registers can be monitored with the RegShot. This will also detect, if we do the right setting, detect changes to the file system. And then we'll use Wireshark to look at the network activity. I'll go through each of these tools. show you what we can do. So Process Explorer is a powerful task manager. And this tool can in itself give us information. And it's good to have this running when you do the analysis. You can use it to, there's a long list there, but at least stack the processes, load the DLLs, look at process properties, system information, and very important, and that's what I'm going to use it for, you kill processes, and I use it to terminate the malware. Sometimes that's easy, other times it's difficult. You can log out users, you can launch and validate processes. We'll have a quick look at this. And remember, this is the Process Explorer. The Process Hacker is very similar. For reference, coloring scheme, pink services, blue processes, and then green and red are new or terminated processes and only there for a short time. So pay attention and investigate. That's the message here. Again, I hope this is more readable from the slides, but it's really just to show you, open this, try to pay attention to what is supposed to be here, what is not supposed to be here, what happens when I execute the malware. We're not covering it now, but what really makes it difficult is this svchost.exe, which is service that is running on all Windows platforms, multiple versions. When malware starts to manipulate and hide in these, this tool will not give you much help. It is possible to use this tool to verify signatures and. I'll show you on the next slide. When you start a program, it launches a process and that is loaded into memory. So if the malware manipulates that process, then that part, then it will the signature will be different on disk and memory, and there are some tools in here to look for that. And if you find large differences, then that's an indicator of compromise. So if you double click on a process and look at the image tab, there's a button here that says verify, and that verifies the process running in the memory and the process stored on disk, and compare some signatures, and that might be one indicator. You can use, there we go. There's also a tab up here that says strings, and this is the strings tab in two different versions. You see down here you have image and memory. This one is the image, so on disk, and this is in memory for this given process, this svchost.exe, the same here. If there are large differences in the strings found on disk and the strings in memory, it could indicate that you're looking at something malicious. This is just a picture of Process Hacker. It works looks similar, probably have much of the same functionality. Quick and easy way of just testing a malicious document using this tool is if you wonder, is the Word or the PDF document malicious? You start Process Explorer, you open the document, and then look. Did the document launch any processes? Advanced malware will not reveal this, but if it's a simple malware, and this could be a quick and dirty check to see if something extra happens. Then there's a note down there, and that goes for all malware analysis. if you rely on a certain program to, in this case, view a document when you're analyzing malware, if your version of the document viewer, let's say Word, is not vulnerable to the attack you found in, if find in a malicious code, then it won't work. So it's actually good practice, and contrary to what you want on your regular computer, where we say patch. On your analysis platform, you want all versions that are vulnerable to several attacks, because you want the attack to happen so you can see what it's doing. So, Task Manager, two options here, probably more that I don't know about, Process Explorer and Process Hacker, up to you which one you use. Look for new processes that appear when launching malware, and Terminate Malware is the primary use right now. But I'm sure if you start working with this, and then there will be other uses. And this is what's fun and frustrating about malware analysis. One person might like one tool, and another person might like other tools, and there's no right answer. And also, one tool might be great for a certain type of malware, but do absolutely nothing for a different type of malware. So you need multiple tools doing the same thing, and just try it until you see what works. RegShot allows you to compare two snapshots of registers and files. Registers, it will do automatically. But if you click this box here and specify here what part of the disk you want it to look at, it will also see if files were created on that disk. We'll look at it later. Another tool, Process Monitor, advanced monitoring tool for Windows. It will look at registers, file system, network, processes and thread activity, has some limitations. So the what we saw in the possible keylogger example, the set Windows hook EX, it will not detect, and it's not good for network activity, even though it will do some. One problem with this is, I said in the beginning, you want to capture as much as possible, but this tool captures almost too much. Up to 50,000 events a minute, that's possible. As we're going to see in the demo here, I run it for about 30 seconds, and I get a lot of events in the startup, but it gets close to 100,000 events real quick. So if you run this too long, you will crash your system. There are filter options, but all the records are kept. I think I also mentioned that on the next slide, yes. Since there's so much, you need a powerful filtering mechanism, and you can, and that's included here, but just remember, the filtering works on the recorded data. It doesn't work before you record, so this problem with filling up the memory, you will still have that. Different ways of filtering. Not going to go through that too much, but I'll show you this. What you can do here is you can choose what you want to filter. In this case, it's the operation, and you have different conditions. So this is when the operation is reg set value, then you want to see that, and then it limits the number of answers down here. This tool takes a lot of practice to master, but I'll give you one example later on how to use it. CaptureBat is another tool from the honeynet.org link there, behavior analysis tool for Windows 32 operating systems, and it looks at the state of the system during the execution. At the low kernel level, And there's it's being, at least when the book was written, it was still being maintained by Christian Seifert, but not sure if it's that's still correct. It's similar to Procmon, but less noisy, so you won't run into that problem with the memory. It's a command line tool, and if you want to capture the network traffic, you have to include an N. If you want to, this can also recover deleted files with a minus C option. When this tool was made, it was XP was the operating system, so it's optimized for that. If it still works, test it. I don't know. Some tools, they are flexible and work on later operating systems. Some won't. So just notice this. We will not use this. And then you can save the output to a CSV file with this option. So the way we use it here is capture bat minus N minus L and then the name of the result file .csv. And the program is terminated by simply pressing enter. And what you get out is two things then. If you use the L option, you get the CSV file, same directory as CaptureBat. If you use the minus the N option, you get a zip file that you can unpack with the 7ZA, located in the same directory. And when you go into the log folder there, it's it will have labeled the PCAP file with the IP address as the name. And this can be opened in, let's say, Wireshark. Excuse me. So that was a quick run through to some of the tools that you might want to activate before getting to step two, which is running the malware. If your malware is an .exe file, it's super easy. You double click. Might need administrative rights, but that should be straightforward. If it's a DLL, it's a little bit more difficult, but not that difficult. You can use the run dll32.exe, which is included in Windows. But then you need to provide an export argument, so the name of the function that you're actually looking for. And then you use Dependency Walker or other tools to figure out what functions are relevant first. So a couple of examples here. So run dll.exe and then rip.dll and the function install, or this is just a random DLL, but then we use the ordinal instead of the name, so you can also specify like that. Or the last thing, you can also the difference between a DLL and an .exe is just a small setting in the PE header, so you can convert the DLL into an .exe and double click it. Next step, terminate the malware. Use Process Hacker or Process Explorer. Right-click and choose Terminate. That's simple, and it usually works. The process, one of these two tools, I'm not sure, have several methods of terminating the malware if that does not work, because the malware doesn't want to be terminated. And one of the more drastic methods I've seen in one of these tools is to actually just write garbage to the memory location of the process running, and so if you don't want to terminate, we'll make you. So then you how are we doing on time, by the way? 7 minutes, good. Step four, pausing the monitoring tools. Depends on the tool, but I want to know to make you aware of one thing. If you have 4 or 5 different monitoring tools running at the same time, and that might be what you want to do, just make sure that when you terminate or open one tool while another one is running, that might create noise in the active tools. And this comes with experience. You might learn what tool is smart to close first and keep open, and which one you want to wait with till the end. Process monitor, you want to close as soon as possible so you don't run out of memory. And then it's the fun one, or this is the hard one. Now you have the logs to find out what actually happened can be hard. 5 minutes, we'll go through a little bit more before we take a break. So of course, the book that I'm teaching, everything is nice and easy, and because they pick examples that make sense and is good to illustrate what you have to do. But in the real world, this is 99% frustration and 1% success, or 98.2 or whatever. It might be 99.99 and 0. I don't know. But it's this is hard work, and many experienced malware analysts will fail on certain malware and just say, this, no, can't do this. I give up. Let's try the next one. So practice. Can't emphasize that enough. Couple of words about Wireshark. Have you used Wireshark and Lossus in this class?
No.
No. Okay, I'll mention it quickly. Wireshark is an open sniffer tool. Open source sniffer, I mean. A packet capture tool. It intercepts and logs network traffic and gives you the opportunity to visualize, look at the data stream, and do in-depth analysis of individual packets. It is known to have many vulnerabilities, so I would recommend to use this in a safe environment and keep it updated. I have a couple of screenshots here. I'll show you in an example, but this shows the traffic, it shows the protocol, and then you have the actual data down here, and you can right-click, I think it is, and take follow TCP stream, and then you'll see the contents of the stream, in this case HTTP GET package. So, but this is not, I'm not going to teach you Wireshark now, but we'll use it for very simple analysis in the example. A couple more slides and then we'll stop. This is important, and I emphasize it to my students, and I'll do it to you too. A lot of the tools, and in particular Wireshark maybe, can be used for good or evil. And so you, as a student, should be responsible and have good ethical, moral code. So it's not a problem to use this to spy on your neighbor or do bad things, but we trust that you don't, because that will be wrong. There's a tool called ProcDot. I'll quickly mention it because I'm not going to use it. It just helps make sense of the enormous amount of data that Procmon and the PCAP files provide. If you ever do analysis, then look it up here. And it gives a nice graphical interface that you can actually maneuver around that visualize tons of lines of data and shows you what if files were created, what register were manipulated, and so forth. And I'm going to do three more slides because then we can start the demo after the break. Faking a network. Looking at the changes on the local system, that's one thing, but we're also supposed to look for network connections. And when we're in a safe environment, we don't want the malware to connect to the internet. So we need to fake the network services. And there's several ways of doing this. But the goal here is to make the malware believe it's accessing internet without actually doing so. And there are two probably more approaches, but I'll mention two. You can try to simulate internet services as complete as possible. The book mentions InetSim. What I've used to do, and it's slower, but I understand more when I do it, is that you provide services one by one and as needed by the malware. And as I mentioned here, the book covers approach number one, and my demonstration will be approach number two. This is based on tips from Lenny Seltzer and using Remnux. I'll show you that in a bit. If you want to learn more, Lenny Seltzer, if you go search that name, you'll get some great web pages. He also has a SANS course, 610, that is fantastic for people who want to start up in malware analysis. I said I'm going to use Remnux. This is what we will do for the demo. You have a virtual machine. You have two machines inside here. You have one Windows platform, and in this case, Windows 7, and all the analysis tools. And this is where you execute the malware. If the malware needs network resources, this virtual machine is we're using Remnux, which is a reverse engineering malware platform on Linux, available for free, that can provide network resources. So when this tries to access the internet, we send it over to the Remnux and we provide, let's say, fake DNS, IRC, or web services on this. So the malware hopefully thinks that it's talking to the internet, but it's talking to our second virtual machine. That's where we stop. I will continue with a demo quarter past 10. Okay. Let's see. See if we can continue. I'm going to attempt a demo. Always interesting to see if things work. I tested it yesterday at work, but today is a new day, so yeah, I never know. Just want to. Well, this is again a reference to the book that you don't have, but I will. The demonstration is not in the book. Not from the book. This is a different malware that I have from some other sources. What I'll do, just step through what I'm going to do, show you. So I'm going to do step one, revert to clean image, start, and then I'll start these tools listed here, Process Hacker, Capture Bat, RegShot. We'll take the first shot. Then we'll start process monitor, clear some buffers, and pause it. And right before we go to step two, we'll start it so we don't get into these memory issues. Then we'll execute the malware, check that in Process Hacker, the task manager, that is running. And then we'll let it run for about 30 seconds. Then I'll terminate the malware, and this time the right-clicking and choose terminate actually works. Step four, we'll stop the monitoring tools. Process monitor first because it captures too much, and then capture bat, and then we'll take the second shot with RegShot. And then we'll look at the results. And hopefully I can have something to show you. So let's see. You don't see my screen now, but I'll see if I can move it over. What I'm doing now is just opening VMware, and I'll, there you go, I can move it over there. Yeah, now I should be, now I see the benefit of this big screen here, because now I can sit in front of it instead of sitting turned. Because now it doesn't show on my computer anymore. Let's see. So in here I have different virtual machines. What I'm going to use now is one Windows machine. With the Windows operating system, and bunch of these tools already installed. And what happened? Cancel. There, that's what I wanted to do. So I have a lot of these tools installed that I mentioned, and I have piece of malware here that we're going to look at. Before we're going into the dynamic analysis, I'll just want to show you a few things from the static analysis. I forgot to put that in the slides. Let me see. There it is. So if I now just take this malware and drag it down and drop it on, let's say, Bintext, Bintext will give you a list of the strings that it finds in the executable. So looking here now, you see this. I don't know if you, can you read it, or you move closer if... And you guys online, hope it's readable. But it says this text. These are strings that it finds in the malware. And this says this program cannot be run in DOS mode. Typical. That's a PE file. Then we see some names here that are sections in the code. Maybe not so interesting. Here, we know that this file is called brbbot.exe. Here's one that's called brbconfig.tmp. Okay, that sounds like a file name to me. Maybe that will appear somewhere. I don't know. This could be Base64 encoding, or it could be a mutex, maybe, don't know. We see the file name again. This one's interesting. If you recognize this, it says software Microsoft Windows current version run. That is the one registered that where you find the auto run when you start up. So maybe this code has some persistence. Says something related to cryptography here. Connection close. Okay, so it has some connections maybe. HTTP. Interesting. ntdll.dll, so it looks like it's looking for that that library. Going further down here, these don't make much sense. But here we'll see a lot of the functions from these libraries listed. So register close, register flush, register set value, open key, delete value. So from this, we can see something's going on with the registers. We don't know what yet, but it looks like it can manipulate the registers. Then there's a lot with crypt. So it could be some encryption in here. What else am I going to do? Create process. Interesting. This one. Create file. There's a lot of functions down here that are interesting. So just quickly go through and see if there's more. Something about internet read here. HTTP. All little clues to what they might be doing. Get current thread. Maybe some process injection here. More garbage down here. This program cannot be run in DOS. Another file name, maybe. This one again. The persistence part. Yeah, and then a repetition of what we've seen. A lot of the functions. So this is a little detective work that comes with experience, and I probably skipped over a lot of strings that other people that do this on a day-to-day basis would flag as important. But the point here is that you have this opportunity, and you should use it. So that was so we've seen that maybe it creates some files, maybe it there's some persistence in there. Maybe some crypto, maybe some internet connections going on. That's a quick indication from this tool. We can drop it into this one, exe info PE, see what happens. See if it helps. No, this is a fixed. Can't make this bigger. This has some information, but what I wanted to show you here is down here. Down here, it says not packed, and if you have an executable that is packed, if this program recognizes the packing algorithm, it will help you here by saying it. So. And there are many options in here that I'm not familiar with. But again, you need to play around with this and just try it. So you see, then I wanted to do PE Studio. This is a powerful one because this gives you a lot of information here. If you're, look here, there's one. I shouldn't have clicked it, maybe. Now it crashed. Okay. If you look here, virus total lookup failed. So this tool will actually take the malware, go on the internet, check out virus total and give you the result. You need to be, now I'm blocked this virtual machine from the internet, so that's why it fails. But there are many options like that. And then you recognize, I'm just going to jump this for now, the DOS stub, header, file header. These are the information that is in the PE header, so in the file itself. What is this tool is trying to do? Here's imported libraries, what we talked about. It not only says that this tool tries to import VS2, WinINAT, ADV API, kernel, user32, and this one. It also has a list that says these two are blacklisted. So that's this number. 2 out of 6 are blacklisted. So these are especially suspicious. Again, it doesn't mean that it is malicious, but when it's blacklisted, it means that a lot of malware uses these for malicious purposes. So you should actually look out. And then it goes imported symbols, so that would be functions. So these are the functions that it tries to import from these libraries. And you see all these register operation, crypto operations, and so forth, file manipulation, are all blacklisted by this tool. So this tool says these are suspicious. You should be careful with these. And there's a lot. 57 out of 96 functions are indicators of compromise. And then strings. It also looks at strings and tries to blacklist strings as well. So it picked out the this one, persistent, this one, and then of course all the names that are probably the same as these symbols here. And you see, I can't, like the what I picked out as a possible file name here, the tool, of course, can't say whether this is blacklisted or not because it's probably not seen it before. And the top here that I jumped over, indicators, it also tries to give indicators and severity here. So let's see. The blacklist of strings have reached the maximum threshold, and the dynamic linked library function have reached the maximum threshold. So trying to say, give an estimate of what this file is. Play around with it. It's a powerful tool and helpful, hopefully. All these indications, they you have to dig deeper to see if it's actually malicious. Because this is just indications. And I mentioned IDA Pro. There's a free version that you can download. And if you just drop the executable in there, IDA Pro is a, could be a course in itself, but let me just show you real quick. What happens then is it IDA takes the executable, try to disassemble it, and show the assembly code. And we'll look a little bit about that afterwards. But again, IDA will also give you the strings. The many tools give the same thing, so you can look at strings. Wrong button. That's the one. We have imports. So here are the imports. The functions and the library it belongs to, long list here. It also lists exports, none. Just minimize those. Not much more to show there. And IDA also tries to, this is the assembly code it recreated from the executable. And IDA can also give a graphical representation of this. I don't know how visible this is, but this is the whole code. And then you can follow and read the assembly code as you go and see what happens. Usually you will look for functions and follow So like this one, call and a certain function. So if you can find one that actually makes sense. Let's just follow this. No, I don't find any right now. This is not what we're supposed to do. But you need to you can use IDA to read through the assembly code, follow different see what's going on, see what it's doing. Find so where in this program does it use those functions that it's trying to get access to, and what does it use it for? All right. So that was a quick look at the static some of the static tools. Then we'll go over to what I already introduced, the demo of the dynamic analysis. Then I'll start with a clean snapshot. And I also want, as I showed you, I also want the Remnux to, so I'll start this another machine that I use for to simulate internet. Just make sure this is a clean shot too. So now we have one machine, Windows machine to run the malware, and one Linux machine with the Remnux tools to simulate internet. We have the malware here. We wanted to start some tools. Process hacker first. Task manager shows a lot of task or processes and services already running. And like I said, if you double click, you get to this here. It should be one that's called they'll find it again. That's the problem with demos. I should find strings and verification. Where are you? Oh, that was not Process Hacker. That was the other one that I don't have on this computer. Remember I said there was two tools? Process Hacker is a little bit different, so let's not get diverted there. But this at least shows what's going on, and I needed to make sure to check that the malware starts and check that I'm able to stop it. So that's why I have that. Next one we can start is Process Monitor, and see here, I'm just going to let it run. It fills up already 65,000 events. So what we need to do here is stop it, clear it, and then start it last minute. So I'm just going to minimize that. So that was process monitor. Capture bath. If you download it, you'll get this command prompt. And remember, we were supposed to, I can show what, I don't know if that's readable, but if you see what's included here, this is what you get when the tool installs. And if you write capture bath, and then we wanted minus N and minus L, and now I need to remember the order. We need to cheat a little bit. I just need to go back to my presentation. And I'll show you what I'm doing in a second. There we go. I just needed to make sure that I had these two in the right order. But if you write minus N or is to capture the network traffic, but if I write minus L first and then minus N, this file name here is not associated with the L, but with the N, and then you don't get the result. So minus N first and then minus L second. Right, back there, and open. So, did I say minus N first, didn't I?
Yes.
Network first, and then we want results to a file, and we just call it result.csv, and then we start that tool, and that's running. Then we want RegShot, very easy tool to use. Just make sure on this one it's already checked and it's already C colon, so I get everything. But if this is not checked, make sure you do that and set the directory here you want, because this is where it scans for files.
So it scans for new files created or changes?
We'll see. We'll see when we're done. But then you just, before you start, take the first shot. And it runs. It doesn't take long, 10 seconds or something. A little bit more. Done. 18 seconds, about, that's what it took. All right, so are we ready to go? We have started Process Hacker. We have Process Monitor waiting. We have CaptureBot there, and we have RegShot. What we don't have is Wireshark, but I will save that for a little bit later. We're not going to include that right now because the CaptureBot also captures the network, so I'll show how that works first, and then we'll get into Wireshark afterwards. So we're good to go, but then we need to remember to, right before we start the malware, we need to start this tool. Just start the capture. Yes, and that starts running. And then we double click on this. And now in the task manager, you'll see there's a process that started that's called brb.exe. And I will count to 30 or wait a little bit and we'll terminate it. But you see this one is running pretty fast, 70,000 events already. So okay. It has some pause music. All right, let's just say that's, see if that's good. Right click, terminate, and this time I know it works. So that's stopping the malware. We'll see that it turned red for a second and then it's gone. And then right away you pause process monitor. Leave that. Open CaptureBot. Hit enter. Then it saves the files. Open RegShot. Take a second shot. Okay. So now we're. See, so now we done step 1 through 4, and now it's examining the logs. See, just there. The easiest one to look at, let's start with RegShot because it's not much happening there. Where's the? I just need to find the mouse again. Let's see there. Two screens is too much for me. What you do is just hit compare, and it would show you the results right away, I thought. Oh, there we go. So here, this is the output from RegShot. Just a little couple of comments up there. And then it's just keys deleted. Four keys. This is the easiest one. There's still a lot of information in here, and you really need to know Windows operating systems to make sense of all this. And I cannot do that. So this needs practice to understand everything. But I'll show you an example of what you can use it for. But it shows keys deleted. It shows values deleted. It will show you values added. See the path here. So you need to find out what does that actually do. What's interesting here is here you see that it's this the program that we executed that actually did this. And if you look at this string here, if you look closely, this is actually the same as this name here. So if you take exe, so this is just almost like the Caesar cipher, but just shifted a number of times. And I remember the number now, but the R is the same as the E, the K is the same as the X, and so forth. And if you do that with these two, you'll get brb.exe. So some obfuscation is going on up here. Values modified. Here's a lot that's something that we're going to jump over. But there's a lot of information here. Towards the end, though, is the results of files. So there are 9 files added. And you see that some of them, like this one, I know it's because I used the CaptureBat. It's the tool. But there's something related to crypto and RSA here. This one, I'm not sure. Something crypto again. But this one is interesting to look at. brbconfig.tmp. It's also one of the strings that we saw in the static analysis. So you actually see that, yes, this there was actually a file created on the desktop, because I ran it from the desktop, so it ended on the desktop. If I had ran it from a different directory, I know that it would have ended up in the same directory as the malware. So we see here, yes, we have confirmed that was actually a file name that ended up being created here. And then there's some deleted files, but this looks like it has to do with the CaptureBat again. And then some file attributes changed. I'm not familiar enough with Windows to tell you what this is, but and a couple of folders, but again, looks like it's the tool that makes it. So there's a lot of noise in here, and you need to be able to, with experience, see what is normal Windows noise, what comes from the tools, and what is actually, like this one, what is actually from the malware. All right. So now we know that there's a file that's being created. So let's go to the other tools and see if they confirm the same thing. And let's do Procmon first. So we can obviously not go through 87,000 entries. So this is when the filtering comes in. This little button up here, filter. And now I'm just going to, here you can filter by category, company, date and time, many different things. I'm going to filter by process name first. So when the process name is, I know we launched brbbot.exe, so I'll filter by that and add apply. Let's see what we're down to 2,190 events, still a lot. But we can do a little bit more, because we can also do operation, and create file, because we saw that a file was created. So let's see if we can confirm it here. And since this is a textbook example, of course we can. So no surprise. Apply. Still 194 events, but that's what we should be able to do. A lot of noise again. Well, we know what we're looking for now. So here's a lot of brb.txt. But down here, you get two lines here. I cannot explain to you why it has this one name not found and why there's two of them, but this line at least tells you that, yeah, it looks like that file actually was created. A lot of other things here if you want to go into the encryption and stuff like that, but at least we're able to confirm. And of course, it's easy when I demonstrate because I know what to look for. The hard part is when you have unknown malware, but the point is use these tools to complement each other. One tool might catch something that a different tool will miss. Play around with this and see how it helps you. All right, so then we have capture the capture bat. I'm gonna go into here, just local disk, program files, capture, and there should be a CSV file, results here. We're just going to open it with a notepad. Maybe I won't. What's going on? Open.
I think it's already open.
Is it already open? Yeah, there it is. Thanks. So it's just a long list of results, and this is... use text search, whatever tool you prefer to sift through this if you have to. Again, we're you see the brbbot.txt here, so you know that's causing something. Should be able to find the register changes in here. Oh, wait a minute, it went all the way to the bottom first. Start at the beginning. So now let's just see write file. Should be one at the very beginning related to the creation of that file. That's what I'm trying to find. You can see here it is. Yeah. So if you just look through, you'll find something here. File write this directory. Or from this to this. So our malware created a new file. Just a quick example. But we also captured the network traffic with the PCAP. No, I mean with the capture bat. And this is stored as this... where is it? The zip file... not the source code, there it is. Capture 95/2017, I don't know, 4.1.zip. This is probably it. So then we use 7 set A extract, and then the file there. Everything is okay, that's good. Then we'll go back here and then we'll get the catalog up that calls logs. That's what created now. And in there's a PCAP file with the IP address associated to any network traffic. And 130.168.81.130. Let's see if we go. The REMNUX that I put up is 129, and our machine is 130. So this is the network traffic from this Windows machine. So let's open that in Wireshark to see what it shows. Network tools, Wireshark. File, open, and then we go here, there, capture, logs, and there it is, open, and all the way at the top here is what I like to look at. There it is. I know how familiar you are with the network traffic, but what we want to look for here is this one, 130 to 129, a DNS request, and destination unreachable. So it tried to resolve something, but didn't find a DNS. So this is an indication that it's trying to connect, but Internet didn't give it what it wanted. So we're going to try to give it what it wants and see what happens then. And now I'm just quickly going to go back to see if this works. If I just do that, is that, yeah, good. Back to the presentation, great. Because what we've done now, we have looked at the results. And then we ask, what do we know now? Okay, at least from the network side, we know that the malware was not able to resolve the host name. So we want to know what happens if it does. So we're going to provide the services one by one. And I'll try to do that live. Yeah. See if it... I'm just quickly going to do revert to a clean VM just to get rid of all the everything we did with all these tools. And this time we're just going to need Process Hacker to stop the malware. And we need Wireshark. Now I'm using Wireshark directly to capture network traffic and not the capture bat. It's just to show you what happens when start. So that's looking for something. Then we know what happened without the DNS. If we now go here and fake DNS, it's a tool included in the REMNUX. And if we now go back to this one and then execute the malware, you see that it's did I start it? Yep, it's running, opening Wireshark. Yep. It's it should get the, yeah, here it is. So DNS brb3dtuts.by is what it's asking for, and it gets a response, yes, I have that. So we get one step further, but what is it trying to do? It's trying to connect on port 80, so HTTP, but nothing happens. So what happens if we give it HTTP as well? And this is a stepwise procedure that I mentioned. I like to revert to a clean one. I know that's, it helps to have a fast machine when you do this. It's, if you have a slow machine, then reverting will take forever. Oh, I forgot to mention, if you can also see from the Remnok side that it's actually resolved this this request. So now we already learned that it's looking for brb.3dtuts.by and whatever that is. So what we're going to do now is to HTTPS. Sorry, on the wrong machine there. HTTPD and start, another functionality in Remnok. And then we'll start the fake DNS. Go back and see what happens. So again, process hacker, just to see that it starts. Wireshark. Start. And then we execute the malware. It's running. So what happens in Wireshark now? We see now that it connects on port 80, and I get an answer, and now we get a get request. It asks for ads.php. It asks for some content on that page. I don't have my demonstration doesn't go further than this, but what I can tell you is that what it's looking for is commands. So if you provide a text document called ads.php and just adds it on the web page, you can issue commands to this malware one by one. So this is a typical example of a command and control channel where the malware connects out on to a web server and expect commands back. What do I do next? So that's the that was what I was planning to demonstrate. So go back here to the presentation. So what we did was just we provided the services one by one. So we provided the DNS, saw that it was going on port 80, provided HTTP, and by the way, this is I did it in Remnok. You can use Netcat in Windows to do the same. So there's always more ways, and then we see a GET request for ads.php. So yeah, and then there are labs for this chapter as well. But that is, let's see, what time is it?
11.
Okay, so we spent 3 hours. Means you get 1 hour to ask questions. Now, I haven't seen anybody online. I'll make a quick check. If there are questions online, please post them quickly. No, I'm still the only one in the chat room, so it's okay. Question from the audience.
What did actually the temp file stand for? Was it just for caching or
the temp file?
Yeah.
I'm not sure. I'll repeat the question for those online. He asked what the temp file was for, and honestly, I don't remember in this example. It's put in the same folder as the malware, so it could be just temporary storing something. But other times, when you see files created like that, it might be that the malware itself creates drops the actual malware somewhere else on the system, and then that's what's running and doing this. I'm not sure what happens in this case. It was more just an example to show how you can find files created and how you can follow the network traffic. So it's
just deleted file?
Whether it's still available on the machine. You see, it shows up here, so it's open with notepad. It could, this would be, this is garbage right now, so it's, I'm not sure what, maybe we can, I don't know if it's executable or see if it makes sense in IDA. You see? No. Failed to display in graphical mode. Yeah, this doesn't make sense, but nothing. Maybe it contains the commands. I don't know. It's a not sure. Then we need more time to analyze. So.
Yeah.
Any other questions?
I think so.
Okay. Then I'll end this recording and just. So what we covered today is a quick introduction to basic static analysis of malware, where you can look for strings, imports, exports, the structure of the PE header, hashes, virus signatures, online or offline. You get a quick indication of what's going on. And then we covered quick and dirty basic dynamic analysis, where you start monitoring tools, execute the malware, stop it, stop the monitoring tools, and then examine what happened when the malware is running. So basic static was without running it, and dynamic is running it. And we saw that that gave other clues or confirmed some of the things that we saw in the basic static. The next step that we can't cover now, but that's the next step now will be to do either advanced static using, let's say, IDA Pro, and read the assembly code. And you cannot read assembly code from the beginning to the end, so you need to go in and pinpoint where you want to read, and that's what you use the basic static and dynamic to do, to locate interesting areas in the code that you investigate further. And then it's also advanced dynamic. You could load the malware into a debugger and set breakpoints and run it up to certain points and read system parameters where you stop there and figure out, so you can have more control in the process. And that's how you build. You build your case, and what you find here will be of great value when you want to tell your boss, hey, what's this shit that I got on my computer, and what is it doing to my system? You can build signatures to protect yourself, or you can build signatures to see if it's implemented anywhere else. So with that, I'll end the lecture, and I'll talk to Lasse and see if how I can provide the two presentations for you, and if there's anything else he wants me to provide or you want access to, then we'll take that by email, I guess. Okay, thank you. Have a nice day.